are rewarded. Well, why is that? They're valuable traits, but we put too much of a premium on presenting and not enough on substance and critical thinking. In his book, Iconoclast, the neuroeconomist Gregory Burns explores what happens when companies rely too heavily on presentation skills to weed out good ideas from non-starters. He describes a software company called Right Solutions that successfully asks employees to share ideas through an online idea market as a way of focusing on substance rather than style. Joe Marino, president of Right Solutions, and Jim Lavoie, CEO of the company, created this system as a reaction to problems they'd experienced elsewhere. In my old company, Lavoie told Burns, if you had a great idea, we would tell you, okay, we'll make an appointment for you to address the murder board, a group of people charged with vetting new ideas. Marino described what happened next. Some technical guy comes in with a good idea. Of course, questions are asked of that person that they don't know, like, how big's the market? What's your marketing approach? What's your business plan for this? What's the product going to cost? It's embarrassing. Most people can't answer those kinds of questions. The people who made it through these boards were not the people with the best ideas. They were the best presenters. Contrary to the Harvard Business School model of vocal leadership, the ranks of effective CEOs turn out to be filled with introverts, including Charles Schwab, Bill Gates, Brenda Barnes, CEO of Sara Lee, and James Copeland, former CEO of Deloitte Touche Tohmatsu. Among the most effective leaders I have encountered and worked with in half a century, the management guru Peter Drucker has written, some locked themselves into their office and others were ultra-gregarious. Some were quick and impulsive, while others studied the situation and took forever to come to a decision. The one and only personality trait the effective ones I have encountered did have in common was something they did not have. They had little or no charisma, and little use either for the term or what it signifies. Supporting Drucker's claim, Brigham Young University management professor Bradley Agle studied the CEOs of 128 major companies and found that those considered charismatic by their top executives had bigger salaries, but not better corporate performance. We tend to overestimate how outgoing leaders need to be. Most leading in a corporation is done in small meetings, and it's done at a distance, through written and video communications, Professor Mills told me. It's not done in front of big groups. You have to be able to do some of that. You can't be a leader of a corporation and walk into a room full of analysts and turn white with fear and leave. But you don't have to do a whole lot of it. I've known a lot of leaders of corporations who are highly introspective and who really have to make themselves work to do the public stuff. Mills points to Lou Gerstner, the legendary chairman of IBM. He went to school here, he says. I don't know how he'd characterize himself. He has to give big speeches, and he does, and he looks calm. But my sense is that he's dramatically more comfortable in small groups. Many of these guys are, actually. Not all of them, but an awful lot of them. Indeed, according to a famous study by the influential management theorist Jim Collins, many of the best-performing companies of the late 20th century were run by what he calls Level 5 leaders. These exceptional CEOs were known not for their flash or charisma, but for extreme humility coupled with intense professional will. In his influential book, Good to Great, Collins tells the story of Darwin Smith, who in his 20 years as head of Kimberly-Clark turned it into the leading paper company in the world and generated stock returns more than 4 times higher than the market average. Smith was a shy and mild-mannered man who wore JCPenney suits and nerdy black-rimmed glasses and spent his vacations puttering around his Wisconsin farm by himself. Asked by a Wall Street Journal reporter to describe his management style, Smith stared back for an uncomfortably long time and answered with a single word, eccentric. But his soft demeanor concealed a fierce resolve. Soon after being appointed CEO, Smith made a dramatic decision to sell the mills that produced the company's core business of coated paper and invest instead in the consumer paper products industry, which he believed had better economics and a brighter future. Everyone said this was a huge mistake, and Wall Street downgraded Kimberly-Clark's stock. But Smith, unmoved by the crowd, did what he thought was right. As a result, the company grew stronger and soon outpaced its rivals. Asked later about his strategy, Smith replied that he never stopped trying to become qualified for the job. Collins hadn't set out to make a point about quiet leadership. When he started his research, all he wanted to know was what characteristics made a company outperform its competition. He selected 11 standout companies to research in depth. Initially, he ignored the question of leadership altogether because he wanted to avoid simplistic answers. But when he analyzed what the highest performing companies had in common, the nature of their CEOs jumped out at him. Every single one of them was led by an unassuming man like Darwin Smith. Those who worked with these leaders tended to describe them with the following words: quiet, humble, modest, reserved, shy, gracious, mild-mannered, self-effacing, understated. The lesson, says Collins, is clear. We don't need giant personalities to transform companies. We need leaders who build not their own egos, but the institutions they run. So what do introverted leaders do differently from, and sometimes better than, extroverts? One answer comes from the work of Wharton Management Professor Adam Grant, who has spent considerable time consulting with Fortune 500 executives and military leaders, from Google to the U.S. Army and Navy. When we first spoke, Grant was teaching at the Ross School of Business at the University of Michigan, where he'd become convinced that the existing research, which showed a correlation between extroversion and leadership, didn't tell the whole story. Grant told me about a wing commander in the U.S. Air Force, one rank below general, in command of thousands of people, charged with protecting a high-security missile base, who was one of the most classically introverted people, as well as one of the finest leaders Grant had ever met. This man lost focus when he interacted too much with people, so he carved out time for thinking and recharging. He spoke quietly, without much variation in his vocal inflections or facial expressions. He was more interested in listening and gathering information than in asserting his opinion or dominating a conversation. He was also widely admired. When he spoke, everyone listened. This was not necessarily remarkable. If you're at the top of the military hierarchy, people are supposed to listen to you. But in the case of this commander, says Grant, people respected not just his formal authority, but also the way he led, by supporting his employees' efforts to take the initiative. He gave subordinates input into key decisions, implementing the ideas that made sense, while making it clear that he had the final authority. He wasn't concerned with getting credit, or even with being in charge. He simply assigned work to those who could perform it best. This meant delegating some of his most interesting, meaningful, and important tasks, work that other leaders would have kept for themselves. Why did the research not reflect the talents of people like the wing commander? Grant thought he knew what the problem was. First, when he looked closely at the existing studies on personality and leadership, he found that the correlation between extroversion and leadership was modest. Second, these studies were often based on people's perceptions of who made a good leader, as opposed to actual results. And personal opinions are often a simple reflection of cultural bias. But most intriguing to Grant was that the existing research didn't differentiate among the various kinds of situations a leader might face. It might be that certain organizations or contexts were better suited to introverted leadership styles, he thought, and others to extroverted approaches. But the studies didn't make such distinctions. Grant had a theory about which kinds of circumstances would call for introverted leadership. His hypothesis was that extroverted leaders enhance group performance when employees are passive, but that introverted leaders are more effective with proactive employees. To test his idea, he and two colleagues, Professors Francesca Gino of Harvard Business School and David Hoffman of the Kennan Flagler Business School at the University of North Carolina, carried out a pair of studies of their own. In the first study, Grant and his colleagues analyzed data from one of the five biggest pizza chains in the United States. They discovered that the weekly profits of the stores managed by extroverts were 16% higher than the profits of those led by introverts. But only when the employees were passive types who tended to do their job without exercising initiative. Introverted leaders had the exact opposite results. When they worked with employees who actively tried to improve work procedures, their stores outperformed those led by extroverts by more than 14%. In the second study, Grant's team divided 163 college students into competing teams, charged with folding as many T-shirts as possible in 10 minutes. Unbeknownst to the participants, each team included two actors. In some teams, the two actors acted passively, following the leader's instructions. In other teams, one of the actors said, "I wonder if there's a more efficient way to do this." The other actor replied that he had a friend from Japan who had a faster way to fold shirts. "It might take a minute or two to teach you," the actor told the leader, "but do we want to try it?" The results were striking. The introverted leaders were 20% more likely to follow the suggestion, and their teams had 24% better results than the teams of the extroverted leaders. When the followers were not proactive, though, when they simply did as the leader instructed without suggesting their own shirt-folding methods, the teams led by extroverts outperformed those led by the introverts by 22%. Why did these leaders' effectiveness turn on whether their employees were passive or proactive? Grant says it makes sense that introverts are uniquely good at leading initiative takers. Because of their inclination to listen to others and lack of interest in dominating social situations, introverts are more likely to hear and implement suggestions. Having benefited from the talents of their followers, they are then likely to motivate them to be even more proactive. Introverted leaders create a virtuous circle of proactivity, in other words. In the T-shirt folding study, the team members reported perceiving the introverted leaders as more open and receptive to their ideas, which motivated them to work harder and to fold more shirts. Extroverts, on the other hand, can be so intent on putting their own stamp on events that they risk losing others' good ideas along the way and allowing workers to lapse into passivity. "Often the leaders end up doing a lot of the talking," says Francesca Gino, "and not listening to any of the ideas that the followers are trying to provide." But with their natural ability to inspire, extroverted leaders are better at getting results from more passive workers. This line of research is still in its infancy. But under the auspices of Grant, an especially proactive fellow himself, it may grow quickly. One of his colleagues has described Grant as the kind of person who can make things happen 28 minutes before they're scheduled to begin. Grant is especially excited about the implications of these findings because proactive employees who take advantage of opportunities in a fast-moving, 24/7 business environment without waiting for a leader to tell them what to do are increasingly vital to organizational success. To understand how to maximize these employees' contributions is an important tool for all leaders. It's also important for companies to groom listeners as well as talkers for leadership roles. The popular press, says Grant, is full of suggestions that introverted leaders practice their public speaking skills and smile more. But Grant's research suggests that in at least one important regard, encouraging employees to take initiative, introverted leaders would do well to go on doing what they do naturally. Extroverted leaders, on the other hand, may wish to adopt a more reserved, quiet style, Grant writes. They may want to learn to sit down so that others might stand up, which is just what a woman named Rosa Parks did naturally. For years, before the day in December 1955, when Rosa Parks refused to give up her seat on a Montgomery bus, she worked behind the scenes for the NAACP, even receiving training in nonviolent resistance. Many things had inspired her political commitment. The time the Ku Klux Klan marched in front of her childhood house. The time her brother, a private in the U.S. Army who'd saved the lives of white soldiers, came home from World War II only to be spat upon. The time a black 18-year-old delivery boy was framed for rape and sent to the electric chair. Parks organized NAACP records, kept track of membership payments, read to little kids in her neighborhood. She was diligent and honorable, but no one thought of her as a leader. Parks, it seemed, was more of a foot soldier. Not many people know that 12 years before her showdown with the Montgomery bus driver, she'd had another encounter with the same man, possibly on the very same bus. It was a November afternoon in 1943, and Parks had entered through the front door of the bus because the back was too crowded. The driver, a well-known bigot named James Blake, told her to use the rear and started to push her off the bus. Parks asked him not to touch her. She would leave on her own, she said quietly. "Get off my bus," Blake sputtered in response. Parks complied, but not before deliberately dropping her purse on her way out and sitting on a white seat as she picked it up. Intuitively, she had engaged in an act of passive resistance, a precept named by Leo Tolstoy and embraced by Mahatma Gandhi, writes the historian Douglas Brinkley in a wonderful biography of Parks. It was more than a decade before King popularized the idea of nonviolence, and long before Parks's own training in civil disobedience. But, Brinkley writes, such principles were a perfect match for her own personality. Parks was so disgusted by Blake that she refused to ride his bus for the next 12 years. On the day she finally did, the day that turned her into the mother of the civil rights movement, she got back on that bus, according to Brinkley, only out of sheer absent-mindedness. Parks's actions that day were brave and singular, but it was in the legal fallout that her quiet strength truly shone. Local civil rights leaders sought her out as a test case to challenge the city's bus laws, pressing her to file a lawsuit. This was no small decision. Parks had a sickly mother who depended on her. To sue would mean losing her job and her husband's. It would mean running the very real risk of being lynched from the tallest telephone pole in town, as her husband and mother put it. "Rosa, the white folks will kill you," pleaded her husband. It was one thing to be arrested for an isolated bus incident, writes Brinkley. It was quite another, as historian Taylor Branch would put it, to re-enter that forbidden zone by choice. But because of her nature, Parks was the perfect plaintiff. Not only because she was a devout Christian, not only because she was an upstanding citizen, but also because she was gentle. "They've messed with the wrong one now," the boycotters would declare as they traipsed miles to work and school. The phrase became a rallying cry. Its power lay in how paradoxical it was. Usually, such a phrase implies that you've messed with a local heavy, with some bullying giant. But it was Parks's quiet strength that made her unassailable. The slogan served as a reminder that the woman who had inspired the boycott was the sort of soft-spoken martyr God would not abandon, writes Brinkley. Parks took her time coming to a decision, but ultimately agreed to sue. She also lent her presence at a rally held on the evening of her trial, the night when a young Martin Luther King Jr., the head of the brand new Montgomery Improvement Association, roused all of Montgomery's black community to boycott the buses. "Since it had to happen," King told the crowd, "I'm happy it happened to a person like Rosa Parks, for nobody can doubt the boundless outreach of her integrity. Nobody can doubt the height of her character. Mrs. Parks is unassuming, and yet there is integrity and character there." Later that year, Parks agreed to go on a fundraising speaking tour with King and other civil rights leaders. She suffered insomnia, ulcers, and homesickness along the way. She met her idol, Eleanor Roosevelt, who wrote of their encounter in her newspaper column. She is a very quiet, gentle person, and it is difficult to imagine how she ever could take such a positive and independent stand. When the boycott finally ended, over a year later, the buses integrated by decree of the Supreme Court, Parks was overlooked by the press. The New York Times ran two front-page stories that celebrated King, but didn't mention her. Other papers photographed the boycott leaders sitting in front of buses, but Parks was not invited to sit for these pictures. She didn't mind. On the day the buses were integrated, She preferred to stay home and take care of her mother. Parks's story is a vivid reminder that we have been graced with limelight-avoiding leaders throughout history. Moses, for example, was not, according to some interpretations of his story, the brash, talkative type who would organize road trips and hold forth in a classroom at Harvard Business School. On the contrary, by today's standards, he was dreadfully timid. He spoke with a stutter and considered himself inarticulate. The book of Numbers describes him as very meek above all the men which were upon the face of the earth. When God first appeared to him in the form of a burning bush, Moses was employed as a shepherd by his father-in-law. He wasn't even ambitious enough to own his own sheep. And when God revealed to Moses his role as liberator of the Jews, did Moses leap at the opportunity? Send someone else to do it, he said. Who am I that I should go to Pharaoh? He pleaded. I have never been eloquent. I am slow of speech and tongue. It was only when God paired him up with his extroverted brother Aaron that Moses agreed to take on the assignment. Moses would be the speechwriter, the behind-the-scenes guy, the Cyrano de Bergerac. Aaron would be the public face of the operation. It will be as if he were your mouth, said God, and as if you were God to him. Complimented by Aaron, Moses led the Jews from Egypt, provided for them in the desert for the next 40 years, and brought the Ten Commandments down from Mount Sinai. And he did all this using strengths that are classically associated with introversion, climbing a mountain in search of wisdom, and writing down carefully on 2 stone tablets everything he learned there. We tend to write Moses' true personality out of the Exodus story. Cecil B. DeMille's classic, The Ten Commandments, portrays him as a swashbuckling figure who does all the talking, with no help from Aaron. We don't ask why God chose as his prophet a stutterer with a public speaking phobia. But we should. The book of Exodus is short on explication, but its stories suggest that introversion plays yin to the yang of extroversion, that the medium is not always the message, and that people followed Moses because his words were thoughtful, not because he spoke them well. If Parks spoke through her actions, and if Moses spoke through his brother Aaron, today another type of introverted leader speaks using the internet. In his book, The Tipping Point, Malcolm Gladwell explores the influence of connectors, people who have a special gift for bringing the world together, and an instinctive and natural gift for making social connections. He describes a classic connector named Roger Horchow, a charming and successful businessman and backer of Broadway hits such as Les Miserables, who collects people the same way others collect stamps. If you sat next to Roger Horchow on a plane ride across the Atlantic, writes Gladwell, he would start talking as the plane taxied to the runway. You would be laughing by the time the seatbelt sign was turned off, and when you landed at the other end, you'd wonder where the time went. We generally think of connectors in just the way that Gladwell describes Horchow. Chatty, outgoing, spellbinding even. But consider for a moment a modest, cerebral man named Craig Newmark. Short, balding, and bespectacled, Newmark was a systems engineer for 17 years at IBM. Before that, he had consuming interests in dinosaurs, chess, and physics. If you sat next to him on a plane, he'd probably keep his nose buried in a book. Yet Newmark also happens to be the founder and majority owner of Craigslist, the eponymous website that, well, connects people with each other. As of May 28, 2011, Craigslist was the 7th largest English-language website in the world. Its users in over 700 cities in 70 countries find jobs, dates, and even kidney donors on Newmark's site. They join singing groups. They read one another's haikus. They confess their affairs. Newmark describes the site not as a business, but as a public commons. Connecting people to fix the world over time is the deepest spiritual value you can have, Newmark has said. After Hurricane Katrina, Craigslist helped stranded families find new homes. During the New York City transit strike of 2005, Craigslist was the go-to place for rideshare listings. Yet another crisis, and Craigslist commands the community, wrote one blogger about Craigslist's role in the strike. How come Craig organically can touch lives on so many personal levels, and Craig's users can touch each other's lives on so many levels? Here's one answer. Social media has made new forms of leadership possible for scores of people who don't fit the Harvard Business School mold. On August 10, 2008, Guy Kawasaki, the best-selling author, speaker, serial entrepreneur, and Silicon Valley legend, tweeted, "You may find this hard to believe, but I am an introvert. I have a role to play, but I fundamentally am a loner." Kawasaki's tweet set the world of social media buzzing. At the time, wrote one blogger, Guy's avatar featured him wearing a pink boa from a large party he threw at his house. Guy Kawasaki, an introvert? Does not compute. On August 15, 2008, Pete Cashmore, the founder of Mashable, the online guide to social media, weighed in. "Wouldn't it be a great irony," he asked, "if the leading proponents of the it's about people mantra weren't so enamored with meeting large groups of people in real life? Perhaps social media affords us the control we lack in real-life socializing, the screen as a barrier between us and the world." Then Cashmore outed himself. "Throw me firmly in the introverts' camp with Guy," he posted. Studies have shown that, indeed, introverts are more likely than extroverts to express intimate facts about themselves online that their family and friends would be surprised to read, to say that they can express the real me online, and to spend more time in certain kinds of online discussions. They welcome the chance to communicate digitally. The same person who would never raise his hand in a lecture hall of 200 people might blog to 2,000 or 2 million without thinking twice. The same person who finds it difficult to introduce himself to strangers might establish a presence online and then extend these relationships into the real world. What would have happened if the subarctic survival situation had been conducted online, with the benefit of all the voices in the room, the Rosa Parkses and the Craig Newmarks and the Darwin Smiths? What if it had been a group of proactive castaways, led by an introvert with a gift for calmly encouraging them to contribute? What if there had been an introvert and an extrovert sharing the helm, like Rosa Parks and Martin Luther King Jr.? Might they have reached the right result? It's impossible to say. No one has ever run these studies, as far as I know, which is a shame. It's understandable that the HBS model of leadership places such a high premium on confidence and quick decision-making. If assertive people tend to get their way, then it's a useful skill for leaders whose work depends on influencing others. Decisiveness inspires confidence, while wavering, or even appearing to waver, can threaten morale. But one can take these truths too far. In some circumstances, quiet, modest styles of leadership may be equally or more effective. As I left the HBS campus, I stopped by a display of notable Wall Street Journal cartoons in the Baker Library lobby. One showed a haggard executive looking at a chart of steeply falling profits. "It's all because of Fradkin," the executive tells his colleague. "He has terrible business sense, but great leadership skills, and everyone is following him down the road to ruin." Does God love introverts? An evangelical's dilemma. If Harvard Business School is an East Coast enclave for the global elite, my next stop was an institution that's much the opposite. It sits on a sprawling 120-acre campus in the former desert and current exurb of Lake Forest, California. Unlike Harvard Business School, it admits anyone who wants to join. Families stroll the palm tree-lined plazas and walkways in good-natured clumps. Children frolic in man-made streams and waterfalls. Staff wave amiably as they cruise by in golf carts. Wear whatever you want. Sneakers and flip-flops are perfectly fine. This campus is presided over not by nattily attired professors wielding words like protagonist and case method, but by a benign Santa Claus-like figure in a Hawaiian shirt and sandy-haired goatee. With an average weekly attendance of 22,000 and counting, Saddleback Church is one of the largest and most influential evangelical churches in the nation. Its leader is Rick Warren, author of The Purpose-Driven Life, one of the best-selling books of all time, and the man who delivered the invocation at President Obama's inauguration. Saddleback doesn't cater to world-famous leaders the way HBS does, but it plays no less mighty a role in society. Evangelical leaders have the ear of presidents, dominate thousands of hours of TV time, and run multi-million dollar businesses, with the most prominent boasting their own production companies, recording studios, and distribution deals with media giants like Time Warner. Saddleback also has one more thing in common with Harvard Business School. It's debt to, and propagation of, the culture of personality. It's a Sunday morning in August 2006, and I'm standing at the center of a dense hub of sidewalks on Saddleback's campus. I consult a signpost, the kind you see at Walt Disney World, with cheerful arrows pointing every which way, Worship Center, Plaza Room, Terrace Cafe, Beach Cafe. A nearby poster features a beaming young man in bright red polo shirt and sneakers. Looking for a new direction? Give Traffic Ministry a try. I'm searching for the Open Air Bookstore, where I'll be meeting Adam McHugh, a local evangelical pastor with whom I've been corresponding. McHugh is an avowed introvert, and we've been having a cross-country conversation about what it feels like to be a quiet and cerebral type in the evangelical movement, especially as a leader. Like HBS, evangelical churches often make extroversion a prerequisite for leadership, sometimes explicitly. The priest must be an extrovert who enthusiastically engages members and newcomers, a team player, reads an ad for a position as associate rector of a 1,400-member parish. A senior priest at another church confesses online that he has advised parishes recruiting a new rector to ask what his or her Myers-Briggs score is. If the first letter isn't an E, for extrovert, he tells them, think twice. I'm sure our Lord was an extrovert. McHugh doesn't fit this description. He discovered his introversion as a junior at Claremont McKenna College when he realized he was getting up early in the morning just to savor time alone with a steaming cup of coffee. He enjoyed parties, but found himself leaving early. Other people would get louder and louder, and I would get quieter and quieter, he told me. He took a Myers-Briggs personality test and found out that there was a word, introvert, that described the type of person who likes to spend time as he did. At first, McHugh felt good about carving out more time for himself. But then he got active in evangelicalism and began to feel guilty about all that solitude. He even believed that God disapproved of his choices, and by extension, of him. The evangelical culture ties together faithfulness with extroversion, McHugh explained. The emphasis is on community, on participating in more and more programs and events, on meeting more and more people. It's a constant tension for many introverts that they're not living that out. And in a religious world, there's more at stake when you feel that tension. It doesn't feel like I'm not doing as well as I'd like. It feels like God isn't pleased with me. From outside the evangelical community, this seems an astonishing confession. Since when is solitude one of the seven deadly sins? But to a fellow evangelical, McHugh's sense of spiritual failure would make perfect sense. Contemporary evangelicalism says that every person you fail to meet and proselytize is another soul you might have saved. It also emphasizes building community among confirmed believers, with many churches encouraging or even requiring their members to join extracurricular groups organized around every conceivable subject, cooking, real estate investing, skateboarding. So every social event McHugh left early, every morning he spent alone, every group he failed to join meant wasted chances to connect with others. But ironically, if there was one thing McHugh knew, it was that he wasn't alone. He looked around and saw a vast number of people in the evangelical community who felt just as conflicted as he did. He became ordained as a Presbyterian minister and worked with a team of student leaders at Claremont College, many of whom were introverts. The team became a kind of laboratory for experimenting with introverted forms of leadership and ministry. They focused on one-on-one, and small group interactions rather than on large groups, and McHugh helped the students find rhythms in their lives that allowed them to claim the solitude they needed and enjoyed, and to have social energy left over for leading others. He urged them to find the courage to speak up and take risks in meeting new people. A few years later, when social media exploded and evangelical bloggers started posting about their experiences, written evidence of the schism between introverts and extroverts within the evangelical church finally emerged. One blogger wrote about his cry from the heart, wondering how to fit in as an introvert in a church that prides itself on extroverted evangelism. There are probably quite a few of you out there who are put on guilt trips each time you get a personal evangelism push at church. There's a place in God's kingdom for sensitive, reflective types. It's not easy to claim, but it's there. Another wrote about his simple desire to serve the Lord, but not serve on a parish committee. In a universal church, there should be room for the ungregarious. McHugh added his own voice to this chorus, first with a blog calling for greater emphasis on religious practices of solitude and contemplation, and later with a book called Introverts in the Church, Finding Our Place in an Extroverted Culture. He argues that evangelism means listening as well as talking, that evangelical churches should incorporate silence and mystery into religious worship, and that they should make room for introverted leaders who might be able to demonstrate a quieter path to God. After all, hasn't prayer always been about contemplation as well as community? Religious leaders from Jesus to Buddha, as well as the lesser-known saints, monks, shamans, and prophets, have always gone off alone to experience the revelations they later shared with the rest of us. When finally I find my way to the bookstore, McHugh is waiting with a serene expression on his face. He's in his early 30s, tall and broad-shouldered, dressed in jeans, a black polo shirt, and black flip-flops. With his short brown hair, reddish goatee, and sideburns, McHugh looks like a typical Gen Xer, but he speaks in the soothing, considered tones of a college professor. McHugh doesn't preach or worship at Saddleback, but we've chosen to meet here because it's such an important symbol of evangelical culture. Since services are just about to start, there's little time to chat. Saddleback offers 6 different worship venues, each housed in its own building or tent and set to its own beat: worship center, traditional, overdrive rock, gospel, family, and something called Ohana Island-style worship. We head to the main worship center, where Pastor Warren is about to preach. With its sky-high ceiling crisscrossed with Klieg lights, the auditorium looks like a rock concert venue, save for the unobtrusive wooden cross hanging on the side of the room. A man named Skip is warming up the congregation with a song. The lyrics are broadcast on 5 Jumbotron screens, interspersed with photos of shimmering lakes and Caribbean sunsets. Mic'd-up tech guys sit on a throne-like dais at the center of the room, training their video cameras on the audience. The cameras linger on a teenage girl, long silky blonde hair, electric smile, and shining blue eyes, who's singing her heart out. I can't help but think of Tony Robbins's Unleash the Power Within seminar. Did Tony base his program on megachurches like Saddleback, I wonder? Or is it the other way around? "Good morning, everybody," beams Skip, then urges us to greet those seated near us. Most people oblige with wide smiles and glad hands, including McHugh, but there's a hint of strain beneath his smile. Pastor Warren takes the stage. He's wearing a short-sleeved polo shirt and his famous goatee. "Today's sermon will be based on the book of Jeremiah," he tells us. "It would be foolish to start a business without a business plan," Warren says. "But most people have no life plan. If you're a business leader, you need to read the book of Jeremiah over and over because he was a genius CEO." There are no Bibles at our seats, only pencils and note cards, with the key points from the sermon pre-printed and blanks to fill in as Warren goes along. Like Tony Robbins, Pastor Warren seems truly well-meaning. He's created this vast Saddleback ecosystem out of nothing, and he's done good works around the world. But at the same time, I can see how hard it must be, inside this world of luau worship and jumbotron prayer for Saddleback's introverts to feel good about themselves. As the service wears on, I feel the same sense of alienation that McHugh has described. Events like this don't give me the sense of oneness others seem to enjoy. It's always been private occasions that make me feel connected to the joys and sorrows of the world, often in the form of communion with writers and musicians I'll never meet in person. Proust called these moments of unity between writer and reader that fruitful miracle of a communication in the midst of solitude. His use of religious language was surely no accident. McHugh, as if reading my mind, turns to me when the service is over. "Everything in the service involved communication," he says with gentle exasperation. "Greeting people, the lengthy sermon, the singing. There was no emphasis on quiet, liturgy, ritual, things that give you space for contemplation." McHugh's discomfort is all the more poignant because he genuinely admires Saddleback and all that it stands for. Saddleback is doing amazing things around the world and in its own community, he says. It's a friendly, hospitable place that genuinely seeks to connect with newcomers. That's an impressive mission, given how colossal the church is, and how easy it would be for people to remain completely disconnected from others. Greeters, the informal atmosphere, meeting people around you, these are all motivated by good desires. Yet McHugh finds practices like the mandatory smile and good morning at the start of the service to be painful. And though he personally is willing to endure it, even sees the value in it, he worries about how many other introverts will not. "It sets up an extroverted atmosphere that can be difficult for introverts like me," he explains. "Sometimes I feel like I'm going through the motions." The outward enthusiasm and passion that seems to be part and parcel of Saddleback's culture doesn't feel natural. Not that introverts can't be eager and enthusiastic, but we're not as overtly expressive as extroverts. At a place like Saddleback, you can start questioning your own experience of God. Is it really as strong as that of other people who look the part of the devout believer? Evangelicalism has taken the extrovert ideal to its logical extreme, McHugh is telling us. If you don't love Jesus out loud, then it must not be real love. It's not enough to forge your own spiritual connection to the divine. It must be displayed publicly. Is it any wonder that introverts like Pastor McHugh start to question their own hearts? It's brave of McHugh, whose spiritual and professional calling depends on his connection to God, to confess his self-doubt. He does so because he wants to spare others the inner conflict he has struggled with, and because he loves evangelicalism and wants it to grow by learning from the introverts in its midst. But he knows that meaningful change will come slowly to a religious culture that sees extroversion not only as a personality trait, but also as an indicator of virtue. Righteous behavior is not so much the good we do behind closed doors when no one is there to praise us. It is what we put out into the world. Just as Tony Robbins' aggressive upselling is okay with his fans because spreading helpful ideas is part of being a good person, and just as HBS expects its students to be talkers because this is seen as a prerequisite of leadership, so have many evangelicals come to associate godliness with sociability. Chapter 3. When collaboration kills creativity. The rise of the new group think, and the power of working alone. I am a horse for a single harness, not cut out for tandem or teamwork. For well I know that in order to attain any definite goal, it is imperative that one person do the thinking and the commanding. Albert Einstein. March 5, 1975. A cold and drizzly evening in Menlo Park, California. 30 unprepossessing-looking engineers gather in the garage of an unemployed colleague named Gordon French. They call themselves the Homebrew Computer Club, and this is their first meeting. Their mission? To make computers accessible to regular people. No small task at a time when most computers are temperamental SUV-sized machines that only universities and corporations can afford. The garage is drafty, but the engineers leave the doors open to the damp night air, so people can wander inside. In walks an uncertain young man of 24, a calculator designer for Hewlett-Packard, serious and bespectacled. He has shoulder-length hair and a brown beard. He takes a chair and listens quietly as the others marvel over a new build-it-yourself computer called the Altair 8800, which recently made the cover of Popular Electronics. The Altair isn't a true personal computer. It's hard to use, and appeals only to the type of person who shows up at a garage on a rainy Wednesday night to talk about microchips. But it's an important first step. The young man, whose name is Stephen Wozniak, is thrilled to hear of the Altair. He's been obsessed with electronics since the age of 3. When he was 11, he came across a magazine article about the first computer, the ENIAC, or Electronic Numerical Integrator and Computer, and ever since, his dream has been to build a machine so small and easy to use that you could keep it at home. And now, inside this garage, here is news that the dream, he thinks of it with capital letters, might one day materialize. As he'll later recall in his memoir, I Was, where most of this story appears, Wozniak is also excited to be surrounded by kindred spirits. To the homebrew crowd, computers are a tool for social justice, and he feels the same way. Not that he talks to anyone at this first meeting, he's way too shy for that. But that night, he goes home and sketches his first design for a personal computer, with a keyboard and a screen, just like the kind we use today. 3 months later, he builds a prototype of that machine, and 10 months after that, he and Steve Jobs co-found Apple Computer. Today, Steve Wozniak is a revered figure in Silicon Valley. There's a street in San Jose, California, named Woz's Way, and is sometimes called the nerd soul of Apple. He has learned over time to open up and speak publicly, even appearing as a contestant on Dancing with the Stars, where he displayed an endearing mixture of stiffness and good cheer. I once saw Wozniak speak at a bookstore in New York City. A standing-room-only crowd showed up bearing their 1970s Apple operating manuals in honor of all that he had done for them. But the credit is not Wozniak's alone. It also belongs to Homebrew. Wozniak identifies that first meeting as the beginning of the computer revolution and one of the most important nights of his life. So if you wanted to replicate the conditions that made Woz so productive, you might point to Homebrew, with its collection of like-minded souls. You might decide that Wozniak's achievement was a shining example of the collaborative approach to creativity. You might conclude that people who hope to be innovative should work in highly social workplaces. And you might be wrong. Consider what Wozniak did right after the meeting in Menlo Park. Did he huddle with fellow club members to work on computer design? No, although he did keep attending the meetings every other Wednesday. Did he seek out a big, open office space full of cheerful pandemonium in which ideas would cross-pollinate? No. When you read his account of his work process on that first PC, the most striking thing is that he was always by himself. Wozniak did most of the work inside his cubicle at Hewlett-Packard. He'd arrive around 6:30 a.m. and, alone in the early morning, read engineering magazines, study chip manuals, and prepare designs in his head. After work, he'd go home, make a quick spaghetti or TV dinner, then drive back to the office and work late into the night. He describes this period of quiet midnights and solitary sunrises as the biggest high ever. His efforts paid off on the night of June 29, 1975, at around 10 p.m., when Woz finished building a prototype of his machine. He hit a few keys on the keyboard, and letters appeared on the screen in front of him. It was the sort of breakthrough moment that most of us can only dream of, and he was alone when it happened. Intentionally so. In his memoir, he offers this advice to kids who aspire to great creativity. Most inventors and engineers I've met are like me. They're shy, and they live in their heads. They're almost like artists. In fact, the very best of them are artists. And artists work best alone, where they can control an invention's design without a lot of other people designing it for marketing or some other committee. I don't believe anything really revolutionary has been invented by committee. If you're that rare engineer who's an inventor and also an artist, I'm going to give you some advice that might be hard to take. That advice is, work alone. You're going to be best able to design revolutionary products and features if you're working on your own, not on a committee, not on a team. From 1956 to 1962, an era best remembered for its ethos of stultifying conformity, the Institute of Personality Assessment and Research at the University of California, Berkeley, conducted a series of studies on the nature of creativity. The researchers sought to identify the most spectacularly creative people and then figure out what made them different from everybody else. They assembled a list of architects, mathematicians, scientists, engineers, and writers who had made major contributions to their fields and invited them to Berkeley for a weekend of personality tests, problem-solving experiments, and probing questions. Then the researchers did something similar with members of the same professions whose contributions were decidedly less groundbreaking. One of the most interesting findings, echoed by later studies, was that the more creative people tended to be socially poised introverts. They were interpersonally skilled, but not of an especially sociable or participative temperament. They described themselves as independent and individualistic. As teens, many had been shy and solitary. These findings don't mean that introverts are always more creative than extroverts, but they do suggest that in a group of people who have been extremely creative throughout their lifetimes, you're likely to find a lot of introverts. Why should this be true? Do quiet personalities come with some ineffable quality that fuels creativity? Perhaps, as we'll see in Chapter 6. But there's a less obvious, yet surprisingly powerful explanation for introverts' creative advantage, an explanation that everyone can learn from. Introverts prefer to work independently, and solitude can be a catalyst to innovation. As the influential psychologist Hans Eysenck once observed, introversion concentrates the mind on the tasks in hand and prevents the dissipation of energy on social and sexual matters unrelated to work. In other words, if you're in the backyard sitting under a tree while everyone else is clinking glasses on the patio, you're more likely to have an apple fall on your head. Newton was one of the world's great introverts. William Wordsworth described him as a mind forever voyaging through strange seas of thought alone. If this is true, if solitude is an important key to creativity, then we might all want to develop a taste for it. We'd want to teach our kids to work independently. We'd want to give employees plenty of privacy and autonomy. Yet increasingly, we do just the opposite. We like to believe that we live in a grand age of creative individualism. We look back at the mid-century era in which the Berkeley researchers conducted their creativity studies and feel superior. Unlike the starched-shirted conformists of the 1950s, we hang posters of Einstein on our walls, his tongue stuck out iconoclastically. We consume indie music and films and generate our own online content. We think different, even if we got the idea from Apple Computer's famous ad campaign. But the way we organize many of our most important institutions, our schools and our workplaces, tells a very different story. It's the story of a contemporary phenomenon that I call the new groupthink, a phenomenon that has the potential to stifle productivity at work and to deprive school children of the skills they'll need to achieve excellence in an increasingly competitive world. The new groupthink elevates teamwork above all else. It insists that creativity and intellectual achievement come from a gregarious place. It has many powerful advocates. Innovation, the heart of the knowledge economy, is fundamentally social, writes the prominent journalist Malcolm Gladwell. None of us is as smart as all of us, declares the organizational consultant Warren Bennis in his book Organizing Genius, whose opening chapter heralds the rise of the great group and the end of the great man. Many jobs that we regard as the province of a single mind actually require a crowd, muses Clay Shirky in his influential book, Here Comes Everybody. Even Michelangelo had assistants paint part of the Sistine Chapel ceiling. Never mind that the assistants were likely interchangeable, while Michelangelo was not. The new groupthink is embraced by many corporations, which increasingly organize workforces into teams, a practice that gained popularity in the early 1990s. By 2000, an estimated half of all U.S. organizations use teams, and today, virtually all of them do, according to the management professor Frederick Morgeson. A recent survey found that 91% of high-level managers believe that teams are the key to success. The consultant, Stephen Harville, told me that of the 30 major organizations he worked with in 2010, including JCPenney, Wells Fargo, Dell Computers, and Prudential, he couldn't think of a single one that didn't use teams. Some of these teams are virtual, working together from remote locations, but others demand a tremendous amount of face-to-face interaction in the form of team-building exercises and retreats, shared online calendars that announce employees' availability for meetings, and physical workplaces that afford little privacy. Today's employees inhabit open office plans in which no one has a room of his or her own. The only walls are the ones holding up the building, and senior executives operate from the center of the boundaryless floor along with everyone else. In fact, over 70% of today's employees work in an open plan. Companies using them include Procter & Gamble, Ernst & Young, GlaxoSmithKline, Alcoa, and H.J. Heinz. The amount of space per employee shrank from 500 square feet in the 1970s to 200 square feet in 2010, according to Peter Miskovich, a managing director at the real estate brokerage firm Jones Lang LaSalle. There has been a shift from I to we work, Steelcase CEO James Hackett told Fast Company magazine in 2005. Employees used to work alone in I settings. Today, working in teams and groups is highly valued. We are designing products to facilitate that. Rival office manufacturer Herman Miller Incorporated has not only introduced new furniture designed to accommodate the move toward collaboration and teaming in the workplace, but also moved its own top executives from private offices to an open space. In 2006, the Ross School of Business at the University of Michigan demolished a classroom building, in part because it wasn't set up for maximum group interaction. The new groupthink is also practiced in our schools via an increasingly popular method of instruction called cooperative or small group learning. In many elementary schools, the traditional rows of seats facing the teacher have been replaced with pods of four or more desks pushed together to facilitate countless group learning activities. Even subjects like math and creative writing, which would seem to depend on solo flights of thought, are often taught as group projects. In one fourth grade classroom I visited, a big sign announced the rules for group work, including, "You can't ask a teacher for help unless everyone in your group has the same question." According to a 2002 nationwide survey of more than 1,200 fourth and eighth grade teachers, 55% of fourth grade teachers prefer cooperative learning, compared to only 26% who favor teacher-directed formats. Only 35% of fourth grade and 29% of eighth grade teachers spend more than half their classroom time on traditional instruction, while 42% of 4th grade and 41% of 8th grade teachers spend at least a quarter of class time on group work. Among younger teachers, small group learning is even more popular, suggesting that the trend will continue for some time to come. The cooperative approach has politically progressive roots. The theory is that students take ownership of their education when they learn from one another. But according to elementary school teachers I interviewed at public and private schools in New York, Michigan, and Georgia, it also trains kids to express themselves in the team culture of corporate America. This style of teaching reflects the business community, one fifth grade teacher in a Manhattan public school told me, where people's respect for others is based on their verbal abilities, not their originality or insight. You have to be someone who speaks well and calls attention to yourself. It's an elitism based on something other than merit. Today, the world of business works in groups, so now the kids do it in school, a third-grade teacher in Decatur, Georgia, explained. Cooperative learning enables skills in working as teams, skills that are in dire demand in the workplace, writes the educational consultant Bruce Williams. Williams also identifies leadership training as a primary